It was a rough day. Well, this is very good. So is this anybody's very first time in DB completely, in discovering Buddhism? Okay, well, welcome. Anybody else? You've kind of joined the most... it's the most difficult module to teach, that's for sure. So just feel free to ask anybody here as many questions as you want. And we're going to do a little review in the beginning anyway. But the topic is, you know, wisdom realizing emptiness, which is you just kind of keep circling the topic over and over again. You know, it's something you just come back to and back to and back to. So there's not too many times that we can study it. So let's start by, well, first, open your prayer book. So what's the page for Refuge and Bodhicitta? 32, 23, 34? I'll put my glasses. Yeah, there we go. 34. All right, so because we're doing this difficult topic, I spent a little more time in DB, you know, with setting your intentions. So... The way we always start a practice is to review our intention, our reason for being here, for studying this topic. And just like you would if you went to the gym, you look at your goal, and are you accomplishing your goal, and kind of get yourself jazzed up for what you're about to do. So similarly, take a minute for yourself to think about what your hope is. You know, it might just be curiosity. It might be to get a little more information about Buddhism. It might be to really expand your understanding of emptiness and karma. And it might be to do that in order to completely liberate yourself from samsara, so that you can not only help yourself, but everyone else around you. And then, you know, we'll do the refuge and bodhicitta prayer. And like I said last week, the reason we do it three times, and often the reason, same was true with prostrating three times. You see a lot of things are repeated three times. And I heard His Holiness say that to keep in mind the very first time you're doing that, to think about all your lives, like we're going to be taking refuge. So all of your lives in samsara, that's what you're thinking. Then the next one is, you need refuge to liberate yourself from that cycle of suffering. And then the third one is to be completely enlightened, where you can be of benefit to all beings. You're still taking refuge to get there. So for those three steps, you'd be concentrating on those three steps as you take refuge, if that makes sense. So if you're not Buddhist, then you just, you know, you can listen. You can also think of what you take refuge in, what helps you. What helps your mind stay calm, and as we're doing this prayer, then you take refuge in what's important to you. Okay, so then all together. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my gifts of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And then we're going to say the four immeasurables. And this is a prayer that you can spend all day meditating on. We're just going to recite it. Also because, you know, many of you know Venerable Rabindranath is coming a week from, I guess 2 weeks from today, right? And I'm sure she'll be leading you through these prayers, probably in Tibetan. All right, so let's just say each one and with as much motivation and intention with each of these stanzas as possible. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Okay, and we're going to start with a little meditation. So get in a comfortable position. If you want to move to a chair, feel free. If you want to move to the floor. But if you're in a chair, make sure your feet are flat on the floor, kind of like shoulder width apart, hip width apart, you know, right in front of you. The most important part being that your spine is straight And so even at home, what you can do is sit on a cushion on a chair so that your hips are higher than your knees, which will keep your back, which will help you align your back to be kind of stacked vertebrae upon vertebrae, so you're not arching your back with your muscles and then your muscles get tired. You really want to have like a nice balance there. And the other point is to have your arms out away from your side so that your breathing is unrestricted. And one way to certainly do that is have your hands in the posture of meditating, which is left hand right below your navel, right hand gently on top, thumbs just gently touching each other as though you're holding a piece of paper. And then you tuck your chin a little bit to lengthen your spine all the way up through the back of your neck. Place your tongue behind your teeth. Jaw relaxed, eyes a little bit open to keep some light coming in, keep you alert. And you're going to put all your attention on the sensation of breathing, either the air coming in and out of your nostrils or your diaphragm moving, whichever one is more comfortable for you. We're going to bring all our awareness to that, and then you'll count one inhale, one exhale is one, and then all the way up to either 5 or 10. And right away, you'll notice your mind zipping around or falling asleep. But if it's zipping around, then what you're trying to do is notice as soon as your mind wants to wander. That's your first goal, is notice that. Just noticing that is huge. It's like lifting weights. You've noticed it. And then gently bring your mind to the count. Then your second goal is to try to expand any space between thoughts. If you do this enough, you'll notice that the thoughts are kind of rising like our inhale, exhale, and there's a pause between them often. And you can lengthen that pause and rest in that space. So just try to work with those two goals for like the next 5 minutes or so, and I'll ding this little bell when we're done. And if you need to move around or if there's sounds, it's all grist for the mill. You'll be watching your mind. Okay, so that was what we call focus meditation. And particularly when it comes to this topic, we are more aware of the need for the two kinds of meditation. Focus meditation, so that we can actually keep our mind on it, on something, and then the analytical meditation. Because when you get to stages where you are trying to really analyze emptiness and you get this glimpse, then it's important to be able to stay with that for as long as possible. And that's where that muscle of our mind comes in. So that's why we're actually going to be talking a lot more about that. All right, so since there's so many people here, who wants to do a review? I mean, who wants to lead the review? Yes, go for it.
I have the handouts here. Thanks, Susie. What? You're going to
do the review? That's great.
It's empty.
Okay, so she's got handouts there and also a copy of the Heart Sutra. So if anybody...
And there's a bunch of people who need them, so if you could raise your hand while you're talking, and then I'll hand them out.
Okay. All right, so what I thought we'd do is we'll go over some of the at least the definitions of things that we were talking about last week, because... when you're reading, there are lots of different, there's lots of terms that people are using interchangeably, and there's lots of very confusing terms, no matter how many times you kind of go over it. But the first one, really, is to give us a good working understanding of what's the term emptiness. And last week we talked about how it's a kind of loaded word in our culture, because the word empty is not just a Dharma word. Empty, when we think of empty, you know, sometimes we use it in a very negative way. I'm feeling empty inside, you know, or my cup is empty, my wallet's empty, my life is empty. It's not usually something we're saying in a really positive way, but here we're talking about something being empty of something else specifically. So anybody want to shout out what we were talking about last week? What's empty of what? Okay, so things are empty, are absent. You could just say they're empty of true existence or inherent existence, which then brings up another question. What is true or inherent existence? That's the next definition. And these things are really, really critical, because it's all like a mind puzzle. The whole topic is a puzzle that you keep kind of playing with. And at least for me, as soon as I feel like, oh, I think I'm getting it, you know, I maybe take 3 steps forward and then a couple steps back, and then 3 steps forward and a couple steps back. But that's the way it goes. It's not unusual. Okay, so anybody have a good definition of inherent existence? I found one that I really liked. Space? Space, we talked about last week, as being permanent. But inherent, let me see if I can find this. I just found this great definition just before I came here. Because I want to give you more of like the classical definition. Pattern rising, focus meditation. Okay, so we talked, let's get to this definition, because then it will make it really clear. Dependent arising. Remember that definition? And what's that? Somebody grab a microphone and... Oh, I see so many hands up. Susan, you're going to have trouble.
The best I understand it just for today is dependent arising is like everything that happens is based on what happened before, and it all has causes and conditions.
Okay.
And nothing exists without depending on something else.
Okay.
It's like parts. Everything has a function.
Mm-hmm.
An inherent existence is something that, if something exists inherently, which it doesn't,
mm-hmm.
that means it doesn't depend on anything else.
Okay. That's great, because we will tend to see things as existing inherently, but when we really break it down, we see that things are dependent on other things. You know, it's very obvious with something physical. But even other things, like qualities, like I was talking last week, that some people would say, I'm tall, but I'm the shortest in my family. It's all relative. So that's exactly what it means. We use the terms very commonly in our language, like, oh, gosh. Oh, there was one, I even wrote it in my phone. I'll have to get it for you. I've been trying to collect all week things that we say. Like last week, I was reminding you of the expression we use about you can't step in the same river twice. That's completely talking about emptiness, you know, and we started breaking that down a little bit. So dependent arising is the fact that whatever exists is dependent on causes, parts, or designations by name and thought. Okay? So they're giving you all those categories because not everything is physical. So let me read it to you again. Dependent arising is the fact that whatever exists is dependent on causes, parts, or designation by name and thought. The opposite of dependent arising is absolute independence. Not depending on causes, parts, designations by name and thought. Such independence is unreal. If things truly or inherently existed, they would have to be absolutely independent. So that's another thing to think about, that inherent existence is synonymous with truly independent, true independence, absolute independence. So I'm going to just abbreviate here. Inherent existence is the same thing as absolute independence. And then we can start doing, we start analyzing things to see, is something really dependent or independent, or what is it? So I'll give you another quick example because I'm trying to catch everybody up from last week so that we're not going to lose you here. All right, so we talked about how everybody can recognize the river, the Cape Fear River, or the Mississippi River. That's easier for me. And everybody can point to it. We can put it on a map. Everybody recognizes it. We all understand what the Mississippi River is. But if we started breaking down its parts, is it the water? So that's why all of us in the West really understand that expression, you can't put your foot in the same river twice. The river's constantly flowing. But it's still the river. We'd all say you put your foot in the Mississippi River. But that river is constantly changing. The water's constantly changing. Is it the water? Or is it the canal that the water is in? Because if the canal wasn't there, it would be a flood. And then we'd label it something else. It'd have a different kind of configuration, and then we would say that's a flood. But because it's in this little canal and it's moving in the right places that we've all figured out, it is able to hold the name river. And then we've all agreed to call it the Mississippi River. Well, those of us, you know, we decided that. Other people called it something else, right? So that's, again, how you can see that it's empty of inherent existence. If we all decided to call it something else tomorrow, we'd all be calling it that. So there's all these different parts to looking at the emptiness of the river. So then last week we touched a little bit on the two truths. So I'm going to erase this. And there was, if you all have been reading the articles, which I encourage you to do, just at least to get some of the terminology, and they're pretty short articles, and then at least you can question me about them. So we talked a little bit last week about the two truths. And we also talked about the two extremes. I have to remember to get back to that. So I'm going to start with the two extremes. So if we think things exist absolutely independent, means they have this kind of we're not really piecing them apart. We think that exists inherently and solidly and from its own side, not dependent on all these different causes and conditions. Then that's this way of, that's one of the extremes of thinking that things exist independently. The other extreme is to think things, then we start looking at it and we go, oh, maybe nothing exists. And we start to fall into the nihilistic way of looking at things. And those are the two extremes that we're trying to walk this nice thin line between. And you'll see that some people, when they start really meditating on emptiness, they kind of get more into this, oh, I think nothing exists. The selflessness doesn't mean that self doesn't exist. It means it doesn't exist in the way we think it does. So that's why emptiness sometimes is a term that can make people think of, oh, it's nothing. It's not It's empty of the kind of way that we've been looking at it. Things exist in these two truths. Everything exists in a conventional way. Its conventional truth is that that river functions as a river. Boats are going up and down it all the time. People are fishing in it. Fish live in it. I mean, it functions as a river. That's why we can all agree that it's a river. So it functions conventionally, and it has a conventional truth to it. It also has an ultimate truth to it, and that's the truth that's a lot harder to see. That's the emptiness of the river. That's when we're saying, where can you say, there's the river? As we talked last week, everything is made up of parts. And so when I used to get into these discussions with Geshe-la, I would get so frustrated because I'd say, well, okay, the river's not just the water. I get that. The river's not just the canal. The river's not just the source. But it's all of those things combined. And he said, all those things combined make up the base upon which you can put the label. You can't have a label without a base. You can't have a base without a label. And then I would try to think of something that had a base without a label, or vice versa. Like I'd come up with all these things. So feel free, because I'm very familiar with the arguments, and I'm looking forward to it. But I used to try to come up with one that didn't fit in that category. So his point is that those two things are different, but they can't exist without each other. The base and the label. Yeah. Did you have a mic? Because the reason we had, for those of you who wonder why we're, you know, you can all hear everybody, but there's people who watch this at home or later on, so we're streaming for them. Yeah.
Well, let's say I'm a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess I have been.
Uh-huh.
And I don't have any language.
Right.
I don't have any labels for anything.
Right.
And yet I experience something.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. Yeah, it might not have to be. Yeah, and that same would follow then for animals as well, who knows if they have their own language and they're communicating about things. But I think what Geshe-la would say is that you're still relating to objects, you know. So there's this classic example of a pocket watch that functions for the adult as a watch and for the child as a toy. So they're relating to that object as a toy, right? They might not be saying toy. Soon enough they will. But they're relating it to it in the way that it functions for them. So just because you might not have a language for something doesn't mean that it doesn't have a label and a base. Yeah, and I'll keep talking about this.
I was going to give the example of an adult who is mute and deaf, who has from birth to adulthood doesn't have language as we think of it.
Right.
But still experiences the conventional experiences of chairs and tables, and even though they don't have a linguistic framework
right.
for those things, or those experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that... when I say label, it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, the kind of language that you and I are using as adults, but still, so when a dog is, it's just the experience, as you said. So I might look at this bowl and think of it for fruit, and a dog then might experience it in a very different way. We're both experiencing the label. Do you want to talk again? Maybe just bring another mic over here.
You may want to take notes.
So I guess formal language, in the sense that I was thinking, that's just kind of icing on the cake,
right?
In a way,
yes.
In a way, that there's something that the mind somehow recognizes,
mm-hmm.
And it recognizes it in this. The unenlightened mind recognizes it in this kind of conventional manner,
right.
regardless of what you call it,
exactly.
formally. But there is this process that goes on
mm-hmm.
that sees this as an object
mm-hmm.
that, in this particular case, an object that has its own existence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we play with it or mm-hmm. do whatever the heck all it is that we do with it, because we think that it is something,
mm-hmm.
regardless of whether we have a formal name for it.
Right. Regardless of whether they have a formal name or not, we're relating to that object. And, yes, regardless of our language, we're relating to it as an object, and we're usually relating to it as an object that is, you know, completely separate from us and separate from all these causes and conditions. But I'm going to keep that question in mind and keep coming back to it. Yeah.
Isn't it the nature of the mind and how it functions to try and define and categorize and recall in order to move through existence? Because Buddhism is talking about controlling your mind, and that's what your mind does. It
mm-hmm.
it evaluates, and we're talking about seeing existence in a way different than the way our culture has introduced it to us.
It's not even our culture. It's just the nature of an unenlightened mind. You know, we can only kind of see so far.
Right.
So then there's other cultural labels certainly on top of that. But just even the limits of our mind and the way we, you know, we're now exploring and expanding it. But certainly just the way things appear to us, they appear in a way that is different from the way that they exist. That's one thing. They appear different than the way that they exist. We're the ones who have to kind of analyze it and look and see. So, the extreme of existence is where you attribute more existence than actually is there. The extreme of non-existence is when you deny something that is there. So it's not that things aren't there, they are there. It's and it's helpful that we see them in the way that we see them so that we can use them and function conventionally. But their ultimate nature is different than the way that they appear. And gosh, sometimes I feel like I'm just speaking like Greek. It's so subtle and tricky, and a lot of it's something that once we get into a meditative state and we kind of analyze some of these things, that's what we're going to be doing soon. One of the classic ways that we do this is trying to look at what is it that is to be negated. We have to identify the object that we then try to refute. That's the classic way in Tibetan Buddhism to look at emptiness. So Tibetan Buddhism is very logical. It's a science. A lot of this is broken down. It has to make sense, and there's these ways to look at it. So I'll talk to you about their four-point analysis of existence in a little bit. But that's exactly what they're doing. And so you'll hear anybody who's like Geshe Lo or Venerable Rabina talking about one of the first steps is, I mean, you start with yourself when you're looking at emptiness and you're going into meditation. You don't start with an object. You start with yourself and look at the emptiness of the self, meaning that it's depending on causes and conditions. It doesn't exist inherently, that it's all these parts come together that hold the label, okay? And that one of the most important things to do is to find the self that is to be negated, the sense of self that is so solid. And I was just reading about one of the ways to do that is you stick a pin in your finger. It's more than your finger that hurts. This whole sense of I gets like hurt. We'll say, I'm hurting, I'm hungry, I'm tired. And it's not that those things don't exist, but there's an I that gets especially insulted. Like another meditation is to think about a time where you felt very insulted or accused of something that you hadn't done. There's this other sense of I that arises, and that's the sense of I that in the meditations you're trying to examine and see where is that arising from. It's not that those things didn't happen, but the sense of I that we have is different from the I that really exists. So that's a very classic meditation we're also going to look at, okay? Any other questions or thoughts about what we've been talking about here? Yeah.
This seems like such a ridiculous question, but...
Oh, don't worry.
Ultimately, are we really trying to both understand emptiness and experience it?
Yeah.
All right.
Yes. I mean, it's through our mind. You know, it's like when you have a, if you have a thorn in your hand and you're trying to take it out with another thorn, you use your mind to kind of expand your mind to be able to realize emptiness. I certainly, you know, did anybody read Lama Zopa Rinpoche's article? Because I hope I have it. Because I'll read parts of it to you. Because he talks about what happens when people begin meditating on emptiness and then they think they're seeing emptiness. And did anybody read it? Okay, so let me just read a couple of little snippets from it. It might help you with some of these questions. What'd you say? Yeah, yeah. This brings us to a problem that often arises in meditation on emptiness. Some meditators think, my body is not the I. Now, this is just like the river thing. Doesn't mean you don't have a body. Doesn't mean we can't see your body. It doesn't mean you shouldn't take care of your body. It's just that it's one part of what we're labeling as I. So he's taking apart the pieces. Some meditators think, my body is not the I. My mind is not the I. Therefore, I don't exist. That's in the nihilistic part, right, of the extremes. Or, since I cannot find my I, I must be getting close to the realization of emptiness. And then he's saying, meditation which leads to such conclusions is incorrect because it disregards the conventional self. The meditator fails to recognize and properly identify the false I that is to be reputed and instead repudiates the conventional or relative I that does exist. If this error is not corrected, it could develop into a nihilistic view, da-da-da-da-da. What is the difference then between the false I and the conventional I? The false I is merely a mistaken idea we have about the self, namely that there is something concrete, independent, and existing in its own right. The I which does exist is dependent. It arises in dependence on body and mind, the components of our being. The body-mind combination is the basis to which conceptual thinking ascribes a name. Okay, so just, this is a meditation. I'm just going to talk about it right now, and we'll do it, or you can do it on your own later. You can think about an idea that you have, an opinion that you have, a political view that you have. That idea and opinion and view, you clearly understand, developed over time. In fact, you could trace it back. You know, a year ago, what idea did you have about whatever? You know, name something. Let's say it's a political idea. What did you think about that a year ago, 2 years ago, 10 years ago, when you were a teenager, when you were a child? You know, you can start to see all the things that went into creating that idea that you hold now, which in a year from now is also going to change. It doesn't mean that you don't have that idea, but it means that you can't hold one part of it and say, here's the idea. It's like that river. It's constantly slipping away. So to hold both of those things, you know, it is an idea that you have, but it's also that fluid thing that we can't grab and say, here it is. But because we're walking around in the conventional world, we think it exists more solidly, and so we get very kind of wedded to it and stuck to it, and I think, and Jeff, you emailed me this week that he read this great quote from Lama Yeshe. Can you repeat it? Give him a mic. Anybody have a mic so people at home can hear it?
I'm trying to remember. Shows you how much I'm getting old. But it said something to the effect of, it was the end of one teach, emptiness makes space to act.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that very liberating because it
right
kind of just takes apart things and gives you a little bit more room to act.
It's meant to be an empowering idea so that you can see the fluidity of all of this. And this is what I said last week, that some people will mistakenly say things like, oh, you know, I'm sick, but, you know, it's all empty. No. You're sick. You know, the doctor would agree. You'd have medication. We can take your temperature. We can all agree that you're sick. It's not, I'm sick, but it's empty. No, it's because things are empty, you're sick. Because there's this river that's constantly moving, you're sick, or you have this idea, or, you know, that's the whole point. And then you can start to feel the power that emptiness gives you, because you're the keeper of your river of consciousness. You know, you inherited it from previous lifetimes, and so now this is what you got. And you can either put a whole lot of crap in that and pollute it for the next keeper of the river, or you can really clean it up and try to put some beautiful things in that river. But that's the kind of empowering message that I get from this idea of emptiness. But that's also very related to the idea of impermanence. And last week I talked about the way to enter into this whole topic is impermanence and looking at dependent arising. That's the way to enter into this whole topic, is looking at that. Then it gets more complicated. But that's the real entry point, is dependent arising. And we, on an intellectual level, we're like, oh yeah, like of course everything is dependent on causes and conditions. But we're not really walking around functioning like that. So there's another idea that you'll read about where some teachers will say, well, Buddhism looks at consciousness different than, say, other religions look at the soul. And for a long time, I didn't quite get that, because I always thought, okay, that's just a different term, soul and consciousness, it's all the same. But what they mean is that in a lot of other religions, they feel the constant throughout all the lifetimes is the soul. And in that way, the soul is like a thread through beads. The beads are different lifetimes, and the soul is this constant, steady, inherently existing thing. In Buddhism, their feeling of consciousness is more like if you took building blocks and shaped them around into something, that there's not this one steady thing that doesn't change. Consciousness changes through each lifetime to become, you know, something else. Another label, that Buddhas themselves achieved that state of pure enlightenment through a process. You know, it's just the river moving to the ocean. Okay, now there's the ocean. The ocean doesn't go back to being a river. The ocean is the ocean, but there was a river at one point. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. I took a lot of notes. Yeah, okay, this is exactly what I was saying. Understanding dependence is the principal means of realizing emptiness, or the non-independent existence of the I. If the I were independent, this is a good thing to think about. If the I were independent, inherently existent, then it would be able to function autonomously. For example, my I could remain seated here while my body goes into town. the eye depends on what the body and the mind do. It is postulated on that basis alone. There is nothing else. There is no other grounds for such a postulation. You'll also see in a lot of these articles them talking about things that are imputed by thought, you know, by names and labels, and that nothing exists without thought. What do you think of that? What do you think of that thought? Nothing exists without thought. I know, that's a tough one. So I have lots of arguments against that. But then one time I was taking a long car trip with Geshe-la, so I like to ask him these questions from the Western philosophical idea, because they have such a different take on it. So I told him the question that you have to answer on college essays, you know, if a tree fell in the woods and there was nobody there, would it make a sound? And he and his other Geshe friend were fascinated with this, and they were like, of course it would make a sound. I said, oh, and I've tried to explain why this is such a puzzle in the West. But their idea was, it's not just whether there's humans are there or not, there's consciousness there. There's bugs, there's animals, there's invisible beings. And I said, okay, but what if there weren't any of those things? And then they said, well, then there wouldn't be the woods either. There wouldn't be the woods, there wouldn't be a tree falling, and you know, if you create, and I would try to, well, what if there was? What if there was some planet up there and there's no other consciousness, just some trees and it fell? And they're like, yeah, then it wouldn't make a sound and there wouldn't be a tree and there would, but they're like, there are none of those things without consciousness. They're all woven together. That blew me out of the water. I can see, so keep thinking about it. But they're expanding that beyond, we're just thinking of a person in the woods. They're like, no, there's all kinds of consciousness. And yes, there has to be, there is an interrelationship between consciousness and all of those things. And it's consciousness that's labeling those things and experiencing those things. All right. All right, let's get me to stop talking, and we're going to do a little meditation. But first, I'm just going to describe... all right, let me get organized here. I want to describe this four-point meditation to you because it's really classic meditation, and I think what we're going to do is just a little piece of it. So I was reading that some teachers just have people for the first month walk around and thinking about the I that needs to be refuted. We don't have all that much time, but we are going to kind of slow it down a little bit. So... okay. Okay. I'm sorry. I just want to read you the, how can I find it? There's four very clear parts of this meditation where you're looking at how you label yourself. And, all right. So it's supposed to be on this page. Okay, here we go. It's called the four-point analysis. The first point is to identify the object to be negated in the proof of emptiness. Start with a truly existing person. So first you have to find that. Where is it that I feel that I'm truly existing? The second is to be convinced that if the truly existent person was true, then it should be found in the body and mind, or completely separate from the body and the mind. The third is to look for the truly existent person in the body and mind. And the fourth is to look for the truly existing person that is separate and unrelated to the body and mind. Find the emptiness of a truly existing person. Okay, so this is classical Tibetan Buddhism where you have these very logical steps, that if something exists, then it must exist, if the person exists, then you must be able to find them in the body and the mind, or completely separate from the body and mind. And then you look for them in the body, in the mind, or separately from the body or mind. Okay? So, we're gonna practice with this a little bit. Yeah.
Thank you. Body and mind are two things. So you can't find it in two things.
Okay, well, that's part of the exercise, is to split it apart and look for it. Is it here? Is it here? And we'll talk about that in a minute. Then is it the combination of them? Is it in the combination of them? Is it separate from them? They'll take the whole analysis to go through each one of those things. Yeah. And they, you know, when you study some of the different Tibetan Buddhist philosophies, it's very logical like that, you know. Through each part of it. It's just kind of a fun meditation too, even though you know you're not your foot, to meditate on, am I my foot? You know, what would it be like if I didn't have a foot? It's kind of a fun mental exercise.
See? What's the first one? Could you repeat the first one?
Yeah, the first one is to identify the object to be negated. And that's the sense that I exist in this very strong way. And the classic way to do that is to find a time when you felt very offended and kind of call that up. Or to stab yourself in the finger, which I think the first way is easier. But, you know, if you like pain, you know, this sense of I arises. And that's when you then, I think the point then is to go back into kind of looking at all the parts of the I and see, no, it's this combination. Some people will get confused. I mean, I've had a lot of people say, okay, well, aren't I just really part of like a larger ocean? I've talked to Geshe-la about this because I said Westerners ask this a lot. It's like, okay, I know that there's all this interdependence. So when I die, don't I kind of like go back to this ocean where all this collective consciousness? And he'll say, no, because your consciousness is going to have to follow the positive and negative actions and reincarnate based on that, not based on mine, you know. But there's all this interdependence, but it doesn't mean that it's all one big mass of consciousness. So And I know I went over this really quickly, so next time what I'm going to bring in is more of an understanding of why would you look at all these parts of the body and mind and the combination of them, okay? And I think it's in some of your reading. Okay. So I'm going to walk you through this. I'm going to read it and walk you through this meditation. So get into a relaxed, comfortable position. And it's just for fun. You're just going to be looking at the label and all these parts. And I'm going to read the parts again. The four points with respect to the person are identifying the person as it is misconceived by our ignorance. The second part is deciding that if the person existed the way it's misconceived, then it must be findable, either in relation to the mind-body complex or independently of this mind-body complex. Three, proving that such a person is not findable in relation to the mind-body complex. And four, proving that such a person is not findable independently of the mind-body complex. All right, so bring to your mind thoughts of yourself, including thoughts where you take yourself very seriously. Like if someone accuses you of something you haven't done, how you feel at that moment, or if someone calls you stupid. If you saw the Treasury burning bundles of retired $20 bills, would you feel that great wealth was going up in smoke? Those pieces of paper are only $20 bills if the Treasury designates them as such. Likewise, we are merely designated by thought, but there are occasions when we feel very concrete. So try to remember an occasion where you felt very concrete. And if that's true, if you do exist concretely, it must be findable, either somewhere in your body mind, or independently of your body or mind. So analyze your body. Check and see if there's a part of your body that you can say, I am this. If you no longer had your legs, would you still be able to call yourself you? If you had a heart transplant, would you still be you? Go through different parts of your body. And then same with your mind. Are you identical with your mind? If you didn't have your name, would you still be you? If you didn't have part of your history, look at different pieces of your history, the things that you've come to label you. Certain parts of your belief system. take an idea that you've had, that you are identify as something important to you, and go back and look at it, its development over time. Is that belief all of those things? One part of those things? Where is that belief? Ask yourself, are you identical with your mind? If you feel you're identical with your body and mind, use examples to look for differences. For example, you can touch yourself by placing your finger on your arm, but is this the same as touching the combination of your body and mind? Now look and see if you are independent of your body or mind. Imagine removing all the attributes that make up your body and your mind. Just like the river, we have now taken out the channel of the river and it's a flood. When you look and see what's left, ask yourself, is this you? Are you independent of the body and mind? Through this analysis, you may notice that what you expected to be there is not there. Focus on the absence of an inherently existent person. Can you feel as though there is like a wave that you're moving on? A wave in the ocean would be very hard to hold, but we would all be able to see it and label it, and surfers would be able to ride it. But it's a constantly changing force of energy. Okay, and then when you're ready, just open your eyes. And what I'd like you to do is get into like groups of four, five at the most, and just talk a little bit, generate some questions, some ideas, some discussion, and then we'll come back and wrap up. Okay? So just talk to each other about what drove you crazy about that, what you liked about it, what worked, what didn't work, where you're stuck, what questions you have. And so if you're new, you know, just introduce yourself to whoever you're around, get up, move to a different part. People have been here a while, please help other people do it. It's hard for people to stand up and move into groups. Is not the mental or physical evidence because of that.
I can hurt myself more if I think that I'm hurt
in the same way. I might have a bad back, but it's not going to be the same as it was yesterday. So I overcompensate. It's all about vision. Yeah, I can think of her, right? But if I attach myself, like every time I'm doing that,
Okay, try to take a minute to wrap up.
My mind could be in your body.
Okay, and wrap up your conversation so you can come back to the group.
Abandon mind in your heart.
All right, that was great. So I heard some good little snippets of conversations. We're collecting questions for Geshe-la or for Venerable Rubina.
Yeah, we got
lots of them. Be careful if you ask Rubina. Well, I'll let you all do the asking. So, what were you saying that I heard people say? That was really helpful. That was really helpful. Let's share it with everybody else.
All right, here we go.
It was early on. You were saying she said so and so something.
Oh, it was about Venerable Rubina. Is that what you were saying?
So we were talking about, I was mentioning something that Venerable Rubina said, I don't know if it was the last time she was here or two times ago, where someone was having trouble understanding. So the person was saying, okay, I understand that I have thoughts, like I can think about this easel here. Mm-hmm. But there's me, the I is what's thinking about, you know, what recognizes that I'm thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So he was stuck on there has to be this observer, this person that's observing the thoughts you're having about the easel. That's mm-hmm. the I, right? Mm-hmm. And I wish I remembered better the way Venerable Rubina said it, but she basically broke it down to the idea that those are just more thoughts.
Right.
You have a mind, and the mind, just like you have the mind that's thinking about the easel, you have a part of your mind, another part of your mind, that's thinking about the part of your mind thinking about the easel. And they're just more thoughts. None of it's the I, it's just another set of thoughts in a different part of your mind.
Right. And so this is something we've been studying with Geshe-la on Wednesday nights, is mind and mental factors. And so, I mean, I'm so in awe of the science that these Tibetan Buddhists have done their whole life. So there's all these mental factors that you study and which ones are doing what and all these abilities that the mind has. And so you break them all down and it's mind-blowing. But, yeah, so they would have a label for that part of the mind that's doing that. Yeah.
Is mind and consciousness the same?
So, it depends on how people are using it. In this country, we use it so interchangeably. So yeah, I would say mind with a capital M. And then when you study mind, and then it says and mental factors, it's breaking down all these parts, the components of the mind, and consciousness is, it contains all of those things, I would say, but it's not, we get back to the same thing. It has all those components and all those parts to it. The mental factors that go are part of consciousness. But they would talk about eye consciousness, ear consciousness. It's a very different way of looking at these things. The very first moment of our eye consciousness, seeing something that we're not even aware of in another part of our consciousness. We were talking about all of this, these mental direct perceivers. And so I think I'm kind of understanding. And then I realized what Geshe-la was saying is we're not even aware of that. Like, we're not even aware of it? No, not at this point. That's much closer to enlightenment that we're aware of that part of our mind. So it just gets more and more complicated. But the important thing to know is that there's all these different abilities and factors in our mind that you could look at and piece out and chart and diagram and see how the mind functions. You know, it's dense. Yeah.
I'm still confused about personality, especially in this election season. I think, what if I were like someone that I'm not like, someone I don't care for, and for whichever side, would that still be myself? You know, I think of karma, I think of causes and conditions and why I'm the way I am. How does that relate to myself?
Who you vote for?
No, how I think, how, and let's say I'm prone to compassion.
Okay, yeah. Well, so, I mean, we're not saying that the self doesn't exist. We're just saying that you can't grab it and say, here's the self, just like the river. It's the same kind of thing if you were saying, well, is the Mississippi really bending there? Or is it not bending there? It is bending there. There is a bend in the river. Just like, why do I have the kind of personality I have and you have the kind of personality you have? It's not that they don't exist. It's based on all those kinds of causes and conditions. Just when you're tracing a kind of an idea that you have now and its formation back as far as you can go, same thing with your personality. You can probably, we could do the same thing with certain parts of aspects of our personality. They're part of the self, how the self is expressed in this lifetime. Does that make sense?
Yes, I have to continue to grab it, though.
Yeah. I mean, the personality is constantly changing as well, right?
Yes.
So here's an interesting thing. So I'm introverted, which is why this is killing me. And but it's all relative, because if I'm around somebody who's even more introverted than me, I look like an extrovert. And I've been in those situations, right? But so I can, you know, I don't know if I was born an introvert, but that's just the way that my personality expresses itself in this lifetime for whatever reasons, because of that, again, that the keeper of the river in this lifetime is an introvert. Might have been a big extrovert last lifetime. Does that make sense? And so, I mean, self expresses itself in different ways. Personality is one, you know?
I'll leave it.
Just because the self doesn't exist inherently doesn't mean that it doesn't have a personality, a gender, you know, age, or race. It's a conventional self.
And as we become, let's say we someday become a more realized being,
mm-hmm.
will we still have a personality?
Yeah. So I would say, you know, so Geshe-la and I have talked a little bit about this, because, again, people in the West have asked him, like, so when you become enlightened, are you just the same as every other Buddha? And he thinks that's so. He's like, no, I mean, you would be able, what did he say? He tried to give me an example of something daily, like this friend of mine was asking, and she does body work, you know. So he was saying, right now, she's not like every other single body worker, but she understands what they do. She shares their same view, but she has a different history about how she got to where she got. And so with all the different Buddhas have different promises that they made, different intentions that they, different, you know, histories, different trails that they blazed to where they are, they probably share the same view. Say they're all, you know, we're all in the same room, all on the same mountaintop. They share the same view, but they're not the same. Yeah. So yeah, right now it shows up as a personality. Any questions? That I know some people are like, okay, now I've formed some questions, that not that I can answer them tonight, but I'd like to collect them. Kevin's got one. Anyway? Yeah.
So we were talking in our group about can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So ultimately I heard that the Buddha is all about not suffering, right? And,
right?
And to not suffer, the bottom line supposedly is don't attach to anything. So how do these teachings about emptiness and inherent existence help us with attachment and,
right.
and non-attachment?
Okay, well, that's a great question. Yeah, and you know, there's so many things to say about attachment. You know, the real way that we are free from samsara is to completely destroy our ignorant mind, which is seeing things that are existing inherently and acting as though they do exist that way, acting as though they exist the way I see them, and therefore creating more karmic seeds and more problems. So when we see that things don't necessarily exist the way that we think they do, it gives us more choices in the way that we act and helps free us up a little bit. It doesn't mean, like, I have a really difficult neighbor. It doesn't mean that, oh, now it's all fine. But I can look a little bit at it from a bigger perspective and see kind of the fluidity of it all. You know, see my kind of connection to it, and that it doesn't exist so solidly. We'll think things exist so solidly like this, and then we can't really. It's the same quote that Jeff was talking about. When we look at emptiness, we see more room to act. and we see the power of our actions. So looking at emptiness is supposed to also help us really look at karma or dependent arising. Things arise based on something. They're not arising from nothing. And what is our relationship to that which is arising? They're arising in our lives. And so, you know, in the West, sometimes when we think about karma, then we, I did something bad, and we sort of do all this blame. It's not meant to disable us. Looking at karma and emptiness is meant to empower us to say, what can I do now? You know, this is arising now. What can I do to kind of shift and change this whole dynamic?
Great answer.
Okay. And also, because this is what I love, I'm the keeper of the river now. You know, and so even if I don't believe in a future life, I do believe in tomorrow, you know, and I can do things today to make tomorrow better, you know, for sure. Yeah.
Okay, so when I was meditating, I got to thinking about the ego, and started trying to pull that out and look at it, and it got to be a little disturbing, you know, that feeling of trying to pull it out, and I felt like it was going to leave me emotionless, you know, and just a shell. And I guess my question is, what is this thing that Freud called the ego, and how does that fit into what we call the mind or consciousness?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I may have to get back to you on that. I know that I've heard Geshe-la talk about the ego is not being such a negative thing, you know. It depends on how you define it. I've heard some people define ego as more like the conductor of the personality and all these different things that are functioning. And so that doesn't have to be a bad thing. It's when we identify as it being the solid, you know, dictator that it kind of gets us in trouble. Yeah, I don't know if you were here last week when I said that monks meditating on emptiness put a pin in their robe and they'll jab themselves if they start to feel a little scared, like I'm losing, I'm not here, I don't exist, you know, I'll just become a shell. That's not the point. And that's some of what Lama Zopa was saying too. It's not that we don't exist, it's that we exist in that. So look at the wave that we're talking about. What a powerful thing a wave is, right? This wave coming all the way from miles across the ocean. It has incredible power. That could also be said of the self or the ego. It's just that you can't grab it and say, here it is, and this is the way it's always going to exist. But if you learn how to surf on that wave, you can really travel. So it's really kind of harnessing what is the self. If I see that fluidity of it, then I have so many more choices. I'm not going to be insulted. I'm not going to, in quite the same way, right? So if I'm not, just on a very practical level, because we have to make it practical too. If I'm not as easily insulted, then I'm not going to easily commit some negative actions which just keep that whole thing spinning. You know, I'll have more choices to step back and say, oh, well, I could actually have a sense of humor about this right now. You know, or this doesn't even bother me. Or, you know, I really need to work on this some more because it does bother me. It just gives us more choices on a really mundane, practical level, which I think it always has to come back to. How do I use this on a mundane level? And it also is supposed to give us hope so that the people that we see and admire that we want to become, they got there somehow. We can also get there somehow. You know, it's not going to be impossible to achieve those states. In fact, the whole reason I got into Buddhism was because I wanted to be able to have a calm mind at the moment of death. And that Gandhi, I knew that Gandhi had died. He was murdered, and yet he wanted to be able to say the Hindu word for God and die. And he was. He did. That's exactly what he did. That inspired me so much. I went into the library looking for any kind of religious book because I wasn't brought up in any religion that would help me get to that. And I saw a Tibetan book of living and dying. Let me read that. And that was the whole entire thing was about how to have a calm state of mind at the moment of death. So, again, it's just that idea that we're not this fixed, solid thing, that we can create something bigger and eventually completely enlightened. And that is not a shell. That's like the universe, you know. So far from being emptied out, we would be full. We would be full of everything. Yeah, but I will try to get a better answer about the definition of ego in relation to emptiness. So unless there's some other burning questions, we covered a lot of territory. And did you have a question?
No.
Okay. So next week I hope to have a little video clip. I have to remember to send it to you, Brian, of His Holiness talking about emptiness, and maybe it'll answer some of these questions. And we'll take the meditation a little bit more in depth. And then the week after that, Venerable Robina is here. So that's why I'm saying, you know, get your questions ready. She'll be happy to answer them. It's a tough topic. It's something that we never just get. We always have to keep circling back. If we really realized emptiness, wow, that's, you know, you should get Geshe-la or Robina to answer. What would that look like if somebody really realizes emptiness? Okay. So let's take a minute to then just on your own think about how much positive merit we have created by getting ourselves here on a Monday night to talk about this topic. They say that just even challenging the idea of inherent existence for a minute is just incredible positive karma that you've created. Just shaking up the idea that things exist the way that we think they exist. Just beginning to look at how powerful we are as keepers of our river. You have created all this positive potential. And now you can decide where in your river of consciousness that is going to be dedicated to grow. You can certainly dedicate this merit to eliminating any obstacles to your complete understanding of emptiness. That your understanding of emptiness, conjoined with bodhicitta, will help you reach complete and perfect enlightenment. And then you'll be able to help everyone else answer all these questions. So thank you very much for your patience and your energy, and I hope to see you next week. Okay. All right. Thank you.